In Aniaka, we're holding on page Yurfes of Eruvin, Ois Lamed Beis. We learned last time that they're talking about how a Talmud is not allowed to decide halacha in the presence of his Rebbe, and there are very serious consequences if he does. The last thing we mention in that connection, or one of the last things we mention in that connection, is that a person who does is Nikra Chote, he's called a sinner, and we brought on the Gemara brought a pasuk from Tilim that expresses that point, where David says, Belibi tafanti imrasecha, I hid your words inside my heart, l'man lo echtaloch, in order that I don't sin to you, implying that if he had spoken at a time when he's not supposed to, then it would be considered a sin in front of Hashem. So now talking more about that, Rav Hamnuna Rami. Rav Hamnuna pointed out, though, there's a contradiction between Pesukim. See if Belibi Tzafanti Imrasecha. So we have that pasuk that David is saying that I hid your words in my heart, that I didn't announce it. Uchtiv, but you have a different pasuk also in Tilim. Bisauti Tzedek B'Kahal Rav. David says, I've given out the news of Tzedek in a large congregation. And Rashi explains that Tzedek means Divrei Torah. And Marashah says also, the point is, if it just meant that he said it, and if it just means that we're talking about that he announced whatever Hashem did for him in the presence of people, then it could just be the kahal. A kahal, by definition, is rabbin. Therefore, the Gemara is dashing rav, meaning that he acted as a rav, as someone who passed in halacha, to teach them the Torah. And it's called tzedek in the sense that as we learned in the previous perek, that David put in a lot of effort into making sure that he would be able to pass in a foreign halacha, and we said it's a special quality that David had. So what is it? So did David hide it in his heart, or did he announce it in public and act as a rav? And the answer is Rav Hamnuna says like Kasha kan bisman she'ira hayyiri kayam. The first pasuk is talking about when Ira hayyiri, who was David's rebbe, was still alive, and the second pasuk is talking about after Ira Hayyiri passed away. So the pasuk says on him, the Gemara is going to quote that pasuk soon and give it a different explanation, but right now the Gemara is understanding that koyin does not mean a koyin as in someone descended from Aaron, because in what sense is a koyin for David more than for everybody else? It means that he was the word koyin can also mean a leader or a master. So it means that he was David's master in that he taught him Torah. In Gittin, it was just a couple of days ago in Ein Yaakov, the Gemara also mentioned there, it talks about how you have from Moshe Rabbeinu until Rabbeinu HaKadosh, you never have Torah Gdolah B'Makom Echad. You never have the same person was the greatest in Torah and the greatest in political leadership over the Jewish people. And the Gemara goes through a bunch of possible candidates, and one of them it asks, what about David? He was the greatest Talmud Chacham as well as the king. And the answer is the same thing. You had Ira Hayyiri early in his reign until he passed away. And he exceeded David's knowledge of Torah. That's why he was David's Rebbe. So therefore you can't say that David throughout his whole career had Torah or Gdolah B'Makom Echad. Anyway, the point is that, so David is saying, as long as Ira Hayyiri is alive, I wouldn't paskin in public because that's for him to do. But after he passed away, then I'll do it. Marsha also points out, you know, like this, if it meant that Ira was a Kohen, then you would have to consider the previous pasuk before it says Gam Ira Hayyiri Hayy Kohen LeDavid. Before that, it mentions Tzadik and Avyasser were the Kohen. So now that means the actual Kohenim. Both Tzadik and Avyasser were from families of Kohenim. Tzadik descended from Pinchas, and he became the first Kohen Gadol in the Beis Hamikdash, and Avyasser had been the Kohen Gadol up until that point. He was descended from Aaron. So now what's for Ira Hayyiri HaYakohen LeDavid would have to mean a Kohen in the sense of a leader, the same way as an Uliyahu Pasuk also says, Uvnei David Kohenim Hoyu. And again, it doesn't mean David's sons are not Kohenim. They're from Shevet Yehuda, but it means leaders and ministers. So the Gemara's understanding, in short, that Ira was not a Kohen, but he was a minister, he was a leader of David, namely that he taught him Torah. On the other hand, now the Gemara is going to give a different drasha, according to which he was actually a Kohen. Because Omer of Abba Bar Kahana, or Bar Zavda, call him a shagir matnois of the Kohen Echad. Anyone who sends his matonis, his matnes kahuna, to only one kohen, rather than distributing them among many different kohenim, may be ra of la'olam, then he brings a famine to the world. Shenema, because we have this pasuk, gam ira hayyiri hoya kohen l'david. So here we're understanding kohen in the simple sense, that he was actually a kohen. And in what sense was he a kohen specifically for David, as the Gemara is going to say. So v'chila David hoya who to have a koyin the kol amal have a koyin. So what do you mean? Was he only a koyin for David, not for everybody else? What would that mean? Means that David sent all his matonis, all of his truma, and the various other matnas kahuna that he has to give, he gave them exclusively to this ira hayyir. Now to a certain extent, you are allowed to do that. Marsha points out there is a Gemara in Masech Gittin that talks about the concept of makire kahuna. You have a friend who is a kohen, and therefore you give him your truma and your challah and so on and so forth. Fine, but with David, since he had an enormous amount of it, of course, because he was the king, he was very wealthy, then he should have distributed it among other people as well. He shouldn't have given it exclusively just to the one person, ira hayyir. Why did he? Maybe because David figured, look, I mean, the point of these matnas kohuna is to support the Tamar Chachamim, since Ira is the greatest Tamar Chacham, and he's David's Rebbe, then maybe he deserves it more than others. But the Gemara is saying he shouldn't have done that, because Uksib Basri, the next pasuk says, there was a famine in David's times for 3 years. So in other words, the Gemara's understanding that that was a contributing factor. The fact that it puts it one after the other shows, and Ira, the Gemara mentioned that Gemara in Gittin that talks about Toro Gdullah Makam Echad implies that Ira actually passed away fairly early in David's reign. And yet, because for part of the time he was there, then it's not called that David had Toro Gdullah Makam Echad. The story of the 3 years famine happened near the end of David's reign. So therefore, why is the Pasuk putting it together to show that there's a connection between those two things, that one leads to the other? Now, Tosfos points out a couple of things over here. So why is he called Ira HaYairi? So on the face of it, it means that he's descended from Yair ben Menashe, from last week's parasha. In that case, he's not a Kohen. But the answer is, you could say that it means his mother is from the family of Yair ben Menashe. Mind you, Yair ben Menashe himself, the Gemara explains in Baba Kama, was actually not from Shevet Menashe himself either. He married into the Shevet, the Gemara explains over there, or his father had married into the Shevet or whatever, and therefore he was considered kind of an honorary member of it. But in any case, the point is, Tosfos is saying, so one of his daughters or one of his granddaughters or whatever married a Kohen, and from them descends this family. So they called themselves Hayairi after their distinguished ancestor, even though they're not Ben Achaben. So he was a great Talmid Chacham. For example, we talk about that when it says by the battle with Ai, so they conquered Yericho and Bederach Ness, and they burnt it, and then he had then Ochan took some of the spoils. Then when they went to check out the next city of Ai, then they came the spies that Yeshua sent to reconnoiter it came back and said it's only a small city, you only need to send a couple of thousand soldiers, and they went and they were defeated, and the pasuk says about Kishloshim Vashisha Ish, like 36 were killed. And the Gemara brings one opinion that means there was one person killed, this Yair ben Menashe, but he was such a great Talmid Chacham that he was the equivalent of 36 members, the majority of the Sanhedrin. So we see from that and from various other psukim that he was a great Talmid Chacham. There was, by the way, later, there was a shofet also named Yair ben Menashe, but apparently that's not the same one because, again, he was in the middle of the time of the shofetim, a couple hundred years after Yeshua's times. Anyway, so therefore he was distinguished enough that the family would trace themselves to him, even though it's only from the mother's side. And then Tosfos says, now the pasuk goes on to say, with this raw of Shlosh Hashanim, that there was a 3 year famine, and the pasuk says David asked the Urim Batumim, and he got back the answer El Shol Vel Beis Hadomim. It's because of what happened with Shol and the family of blood that Hashem was saying there are two things: that Shol killed the Givonim, where you have the story over there because he killed the Kohenim of Noiv, and some Givonim were killed along with them, and the rest of them lost their Parnasa because now the Mishkan is not located by them anymore. And you also have Hashem was critical of the fact that when that Shol was buried in secret over there, which in fairness, I mean, they had to, you know, Plishtim had killed him and hanged his body up on the wall, and people of Yavish Gilad at the end of Shmuel Aleph had to sneak into Plishti territory and get the body. But still, Hashem was upset that all these years later, they didn't make a nice Levaya for Shol and make a proper Hesped for him. So for those reasons, Hashem brought the famine. So in that case, what does it have to do with David and his Matnas Kohuna? The answer is, Tosfos says, okay, it means evidently that there was more than one factor. So you had the factor of Shol, the two things with Shol. Number one, how he mistreated the Givonim, and how, on the other hand, he didn't have a proper hesped and a proper burial. But there's also another contributing factor, was this point about David not giving his matnas kohuna exclusively to Ira, rather than to all the other chacham, rather than to all the other kohen. In fact, the Rif talks about in some detail over here, since there was a 3-year famine, it's very possible you could say, maybe the Gemara is implying that there were 3 different causes, each of which caused 1 year of it. One is how Shaul treated the Givonim. One is how Shaul himself did not have a proper hesped and burial. And the third one is David giving his Matnas Kehuna exclusively to Ira. By the way, the Medrash says on this that when they had, so this is the first year they had this famine, it's a David was and the Sanhedrin were putting their heads together to figure out what could cause it. So they realized, you know, listen, one thing it says in the Torah is if there's Avodah Zarah in Eretz Yisrael, then that can cause all sorts of Shemayim below Yamater. So they checked throughout Eretz Yisrael and they found there's no trace of Avodah Zarah. The second year, the famine is still going on. They say, I don't remember the exact Seder, but whatever. The second year, they figured maybe it's been one year. They figured maybe it's because people are weighing and measuring dishonestly, where it says that, or because they're poskit tzedakah barabim, they're promising to give tzedakah and then not giving it. And the Gemara in Tainus tells us that can cause a drought. So they checked out each one of those things in turn and didn't find it. It shows what level the people were on, that they couldn't find a trace of any of those averas all in Eretz Yisrael. So then at that point, David realizes to himself, okay, well, not the Jewish people, then it must be something with me. And at that point, he asks the Urim Thummim and gets the answer. Anyway, so we're saying again that one of the contributing factors is him not doing properly with his Matnas Kehuna and distributing it among other Kohanim. So the Gemara continues back to the point about a Talmud paskening or speaking up in the presence of his Rebbe. Omer of Abba or of Levi called him Moisiv Mila Kamei Rabbi. Anybody who speaks up where he's not supposed to, in front of his Rebbe. So now, we said at the beginning of the sugya, where there's Chilul Hashem involved, where if somebody is doing an Aveira, and you have to lafrush in the Isura to tell him to stop doing that Isura, that's different than Ein Chochma Vein Eitzah, etc., the Negan Hashem. But here we're talking about when there's not that. So Rav Abba, or Rav Levi says, such a person, such a Talmud, will end up going to the grave without having any sons. You can do tshuva, but nevertheless, in other words, there's still a certain effect of it. There's still a certain effect that he's not going to have sons. It's as if he's saying that his Rebbe is not capable of saying this and he needs to speak up instead. So therefore he ends up not having a son who would be able to take over for him as to be the next generation of Talmud Chacham after him. So Shanema, you find in Parshas Bahaloska, when Elder the Maidar Misnabim Bamachne, and someone comes, Vayoratanar, and someone comes, a boy comes, it actually says over there it was Gershom, Moshe's son, comes and tells him, Elder the Maidar Misnabim Bamachne. The pasuk is Vayan Yeshua bin Nun, Mishores Moshe Mabachorov, Yeshua bin Nun, who was Moshe's attendant ever since his youth. And he spoke up and he said, "By Yomar, Adoni Moshe Kloim, my master Moshe Kloim." Where Rashi brings on the pasuk two possibilities. It means put on them tzorchit zibur, that based on a Gemara and Sanhedrin. One of them, he says, that make them have to do tzorchit zibur, and then that'll wear them out on their own, and they won't be able to become neviim or put them in jail. Whatever the case, the point is that Yeshua is speaking up and telling Moshe that you have to do such and such. So he shouldn't have done that. And Marashal explains that's why the pasuk makes a point of stressing Mishoris Moshe Mibachurav, because he's Mishoris Moshe Mibachurav, because he's been for so long a Mishoris and a Talmud of Moshe, he should have known better than to speak up in front of Moshe. Now, this is not Moda Halacha per se, but it still amounts to the same thing. It's like telling Moshe what to do. And Uchdiv and a Divrei Yomim, it lists the whole family tree from Ephraim going all the way down, Ben Achaben, down to Yeshua, and it finishes off, Noin B'noi Yeshua B'noi. You have Noin, who's in general in Chumash and in most of the places, it's called Yeshua bin Nun, but really based on this pasuk and Divrei Yomim, it seems that his father's name was actually Noin. And before I think they have an Ezra or someone says that bin Nun is easier to pronounce than Ben Noin, or Bin Noin, or whatever, and therefore he became known as that. But in any case, the point is that it finishes off, Noin Bno Yoshua Bnoi, and then it stops right there, implying that he had no sons. Otherwise, you'd expect the pasuk to list his sons. Which, by the way, there is a Gemara in Megillah that explains that Yeshua did have daughters. It mentions over there, he married Rochav, the famous Rochav who hid the spies near the beginning of Sefer Yeshua. We read it as the Haftarah of Parashas Shlach. So afterwards, she recognized that Hashem is the only power in the entire universe. And to make a long story short, she and her family became Gerim, and she ended up marrying Yeshua. So the Gemara says, but they were in Megillah, they had daughters, and eventually, generations later, from those daughters, descended 8 great Nevi'im, including Yirmiyah and his father, and including Yechezkel and his father, all of who were Nevi'im. plus four others from that family. But the point is, though, he didn't have sons, so he wasn't able to be Makai in the mitzvah of Piri Viribia. And that was as a result, the Gemara is saying, Reb Abba or Reb Levi is saying, as a result of him speaking up over there and saying, Adoni Moshe Kloin. However, the Gemara says, a pligot that Reb Abba bar Papa, now this explanation that was why Yeshua lost the privilege of having sons disagrees with an explanation of, and by the way, Ion Yaakov points out, I mean, before we learned that a Talmud of Moda Alocha B'Fnei Abba is Chayiv Nisa, here we're saying that Yeshua kind of got off easy. First of all, the fact is, again, he does have the schus that he was Meshamish Moshe, so therefore that allows him to get a break. And also because Yeshua is, after all, saying it for the covenant of Moshe. So therefore, that kind of mitigates his punishment. But yeah. Anyway, so pligot of Abba bar Papa. This explanation disagrees with Abba bar Papa, the Amr of Abba bar Papa, Lenenash Yeshua. Yeshua was not punished with this, that he didn't have a son. Because he prevented the Jewish people from doing pruvu for one night. And therefore, so he himself was punished by not being able to fulfill pruvu. Where do we see that he did that? Shenemar, you have like this. The Pasuk says, we have an after to the first day Pesach. When Yeshua is in Yericho, and it doesn't actually mean he wasn't yet in Yericho. This is in Perak Hei, Yericho is only conquered, and then in Perak Vav. It means he was in the outskirts of Yericho. In fact, the Gemara elsewhere learns from that the outskirts of a city are considered to a certain extent like the city itself. Anyway, he's in the area of Yericho, and a malach appears to him, and Yeshua asks him, "Halonu ata im l'tzareinu? Are you on our side or are you for our enemies?" And the pasuk says, "Vayomer loy," and he said, "No, ki ani sar tzva Hashem ata bosi." I am the commander of the army of Hashem. I have now come. So what's going on over here? What is Yeshua asking? And what is the Malach replying? Especially the Loi seems out of place. I mean, Yeshua didn't ask him a yes or no question. He would say, I'm Lochem, or I'm Lotzarech, or whatever. So it means, Omalei, means the Malach tells, and Rashi adds also the point, the Pasuk describes the Malach was coming, he had a drawn sword in his hand, implying that he's coming there for some kind of punishment. The Jewish people have done something wrong, and therefore the Malach is coming with a sword against them. So that's why Yeshua is asking. So Omale, so the Malach tells him, Emesh bitaltim tomer choben habayim, yesterday, because you were so busy preparing for the war against Yericho, you didn't bring the tomer choben habayim. And now it's at night, and now you're making it worse by being mevatel Talmud Torah. Now the point is, Rashi explains, okay, they're busy fighting and preparing for war by day, so they don't have the time by day to learn so much, but at least by night they should be learning Torah. So he's telling him you did two things wrong. So Yeshua asks him, which one are you coming to tell us all for? He says, I've come now. So that can mean one meaning of it is, in other words, he's saying, I'm coming about the thing that's going on right now. The fact that you missed the Tom and Shoban Habayim, fine, that's it's a done deal. There's no making up for that. Tosfos in Megillah, by the way, this Gemara is also in Megillah, discusses, so why Taka did they miss the Tom and Shoban Habayim? And they discuss because, as the Gemara is going to say soon, the Oren wasn't in its proper place, and therefore they didn't, because they had it with them, getting ready for the war in Yericho. Meanwhile, the Mishkan is located in Gilgal, which is some miles away from there. So therefore, they were busy with that, the Kohen were busy bringing the Oren or whatever, and they forgot to bring the Talmud Shoban Habayim. But now the Malach is saying, Ata Bosi, I'm coming now. In other words, I'm coming about the thing that's going on right now. That's how Rashi explains it in Megillah. The Tosfos over there in Megillah brings a different reason. Marashah quotes it. The word Ata refers to Va'ata Kisva Lachem Ashira Azos, which is talking about writing the Torah. And therefore, by using the word Ata, the Malach is hinting, I'm coming regarding the Torah. In fact, Tosfos says over there that when Yeshua asks Halonu Ata Imutzarenu, he's also hinting the same question. He's saying, are you coming because of Lonu, because of Torah Tziva Lonu Moshe, or are you coming with Sarenu? Are you coming because of the mist Korban, where the Korban protects us from our enemies? And he's answering him Ata Bosi, as in the Ata Kisva Lachemus Ashira Azos. So I'm coming about the fact that Hashem is upset with you that you're not learning Torah. So miyad, so right away, meaning the next opportunity that Yeshua had a chance to fix that up, as the pasuk says, "Vayolan Yeshua v'alayla ohu b'seicha am ochtiv vayelach Yeshua v'alayla ohu b'seicha emek." You have two different psukim, a few psukim apart, in Perek Ches, what it's talking about when they're preparing for the second battle against Ai. So again, you have the first battle where they misjudged the strength of it, and it was after Achan had taken from the spoils over there, and therefore the Jewish people were defeated. Then they daven, and Hashem tells them that you have to get rid of Achan and everything that he stole, etc., etc. So then they come back for the attack against Ai again, and you have two psukim over there. One says, "Vayolan Yeshua b'alaylo ahu b'seicha am." Yeshua slept overnight that night among the people. Uchtiv, and a few psukim later, it says, "Vayelach Yeshua b'alaylo ahu b'seicha emek." Yeshua walked that night in the valley. So the Gemara is kind of combining the two psukim together. This teaches us that Yeshua that night, he slept over, or he didn't sleep actually. He stayed up that night in the depths of halacha emek, maloshin oimek, as in depth. So in other words, so the Malach having told them off before the battle with Yericho, so now the very next opportunity before the next battle of Ai, then Yeshua showed that he had fixed up that mistake. Instead of just their figuring, well, we worked all day on preparing for the battle, therefore by night we should sleep. Instead, he spent that night learning Torah. Both Rashi and Tosfos point out that we don't mean miyad, doesn't mean immediately the next night, it means the next opportunity. Tosfos and Megillah also points out again that the Gemara is kind of combining together these two psukim, and the Gemara often will do that. Gemara often combines together parts of different psukim and paraphrases them in order to get a drasha. So therefore, so we take the vayolin from the one pasuk and the seicha emek of the other and combining them together, and that gives us this drasha. Anyway, the point is, what does this have to do with Yeshua preventing the people from doing pruvu ugmirin? Because we have the Kabbalah, as long as the Oren and the Shechina that goes with it is not in its proper place, then at that point, Jews are also to do tashmish amitta. Therefore, they can't do pruvu. Now, what happened that night when the Malach comes to Yeshua is, so he was telling them off that they were saying Talmud Torah. Now he's also telling them that you should have returned the Oren every day. Yes, you're supposed to be, every day you're going to be circling around Yericho with the Oren, as it describes over there in the Psukim, but every night you should be bringing it back to Gilgal, which is where the Mishkan is set up, so that the people will be mutter in Pruvu, and tonight you didn't do that. So therefore, so Yeshua had prevented the people from that night from doing Pruvu. And Tosfos points out, now, so how do we know? So we're saying that Yeshua, because of that, lost the opportunity to have a son. Okay, so maybe it was because he was Mevatel Talmud Torah. Tosfos says, yeah, but that wouldn't be Midah Keneged Midah. If we're saying that the Midah Keneged, if we're saying because of that, he lost the opportunity to have a son, then that fits better with the fact that he was Mevatel them from Pru Avu that one night, and therefore he lost the opportunity to do Pru Avu himself. Tosfos also gets into a discussion over here, among other things. So what happened every other time there was a war? Does that mean every time there's a war, they're also in Tashmish Amitah? So here's where Tosfos brings you have the famous point about that there were two Aronis. You have the Oren that Bezalel made. You have the Oren that describes in Parashas Ekev that Moshe made. And the Yerushalmi talks about this and then brings, according to one opinion, yeah, there were two Aronis. One of them contained the whole Luchas. The other one contained the broken Luchas. Now, there's Gemara and the Bavli and Baba Basra seems to not say that way. It says that both the Luchas and the Shivrei Luchas were in the one Oren, but the Yerushalmi at least learns that there were actually two Aronis. There was the one that Moshe made and the one Bezalel made. The one that Moshe made contained the broken Luchas. The ones that Bezalel made contained the whole Luchas. That one that was plated with gold that Bezalel made, that one generally stayed all the time in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. They never took it out for war, except, so now they took it out for the marches around Yericho. And also we find in the times of Eli HaKohen, they brought it out again for the war against the Plishtim, and then it was captured, and you have the whole story over there in Sefer Shmuel of what happened with it. In fact, Tosfos brings, based on that, that's why you find in the Psukim in Sefer Shmuel, when they brought the Oren to the Machna, the Plishtim at first were panicked, and they said, "Oy lonu, woe is to us, nothing like this ever happened before." I mean, nothing like this ever happened before. Every other time you fought the Yidden, you had to have the Oren with them, because every other time they had the Oren with the broken Luchas. Now, for the first time, they brought the one with the whole Luchas, and therefore the Plishtim found out about it, and they were nervous at first until they rallied. Anyway, the point is, so if there were two aronis, then fine. When they take out the one with the broken luchos, that doesn't have anything to do with tashmish amita. But in this case, with Yerichai, and also then, they took out the whole one. Therefore, it becomes also in tashmish amita during that time. And since Yehoshua didn't make sure that it was put back that night, and therefore, that's what we're saying over here. There were the consequences that the Gemara is saying. So during that whole time that it was captured, it's a good question. Were they also in tashmish amita? Maybe taka, I don't know. It doesn't, I don't think it says one way or the other, but But the other possibility, the truth is that, you have, even after it was captured, it was eventually brought back. It was brought to Beis Shemesh and then to Kiryas Yorim and then to Yerushalayim. In fact, Tosfos points out that you could say that when it was in Yerushalayim during all the years, once David brought it to Yerushalayim and it's in a tent over there, it's also not in its proper place, but it's not together with the rest of the Mishkan. Still, we don't find people are also in Tashmish Amita during that time. You do find that Uriah makes an excuse to say that why should I go and then and sleep with my wife? And Tosfos says maybe Uriah is taking the view that since you have two things at that point, it's not in its place, and there's a war going on, then maybe that's a reason to be machmir. So according to that, it would come out that during that time when it was by the Plishtim and during the years after that, when it was in Kiryas Yearim and so on and so forth, maybe only, according to one possibility in Tosfos, maybe only when there's a war going on is there an issue that you can't have Tashmish Amita, but otherwise not. You could say maybe because after all, the Mishkan afterwards in Gilgal and in Noib and in Gibbon didn't have the full status of a Mishkan. It was called a Bama Gdola. For that reason, you were allowed to bring Karbonis anywhere else in Eretz Yisrael. So maybe this concept of the Orin not being in its proper place doesn't apply during that time. I don't know. So the Gemara finishes off. Amar of Shmuel bar Ivyo or Unya Mishmei Derab Godol Talmud Torah Yosim Akdrovas Tmidim. We see from this story that learning Torah is even more important than bringing the Korbanos Tamid Shenema Atabasi, because that's what we see. The Malach is telling Yeshua, I'm coming because of now, because of the Torah, rather than in other words, he's saying even though there are two things wrong over here, the one that I'm really coming about to tell you off for is the lack of learning Torah. So we see that's even more important than bringing the Tmidim. In this connection, speaking of interfering with Tashmish Amita, the Gemara mentions Amar Bruno Amar Rav Kola Yoshin Bekila Sheish VeIshte Shruyin Ba. When a third party sleeps in the same room where a husband and wife are sleeping, all of Akosiv Omer on such a person, the pasuk says Nishay Ami Tegoshin Mibes Tanu Geha. You kick out the wives of my people from the place of her pleasure. In other words, because now they're embarrassed. They have somebody else in the room, so now they can't. They can't have relations. Amar Rav Yosef lo nitzrucha afilu ishtei nida. However, Rav Yosef says that the chiddush of that is even if the wife is a nida, so they're anyway not going to be having relations, but they want to be able to have private conversations. You have where a couple are lying in their respective beds. They still want to have private talk that they can't during the day. So therefore, so if somebody else is there, then we're saying even at a time like that, he shouldn't be there. On the other hand, Rava Amar im ishtei nida tavo el bracha. Rava says, what do you mean? If it's ishtei nida, then adraba, if somebody else is sleeping in the room, tavo el bracha, he's preventing, because without him being there, they might have the taiva to have relations, and he's preventing that from happening. However, the Gemara says, v'lo hi, that's not so. Because after all, who watched them until now? The fact is, Marasha says, we find the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that even though Isur Nida is a very serious Isur, nevertheless, Suga Basheshanim, the Jewish people are like a hedge of roses around, even though roses would be very easy to trample them, but you don't. So the same way, we have a mitzvah of Nida, and even though a husband and wife have tremendous taiva for each other, but they know to stay away from each other when she's Nida, and therefore you don't need a shomer and you don't need nothing, and therefore there's no tovei ala bracha of somebody staying in there. There is still the point, they may not be able to have relations, but they want to be able to have private conversations, and they can't do that when somebody else is in the room. And that's takad halacha, and it's brought in Shulchan Aruch accordingly. The one exception to that is you have a chosen kala, if there happens to be, for whatever reason, a chupas nida, or if she becomes nida before they have the chance to have relations, then they have to have a shomer and a shemeres with them respectively. That's a special case. But other than that, once they're already married and had relations before, then the Eibishter to trust a couple that they don't need a shomer with them to make sure that they're not over. Okay, on to Yechezkel. We're holding in Yechezkel, Perek Mem Aleph. We started Pasuk Vav last time, but we'll start it over again and try to explain it a little better. So Yechezkel was starting to describe, the Malach was going to show him the rooms, the little chambers around the Heichal. Now you have two different diagrams over here because there's going to be a point in Pasuk Tes where there's two different explanations in Rashi about a particular detail over there, which the Pasuk calls the Munach, which means the empty space. So you have two different ways of understanding it, and which Rashi gives over there, and the result is two different ways of picturing how these chambers are arranged around the Heichal. So you have one explanation in Pasuk Tes is that Munach is the space over here. You have the Ulam. On the two sides of the Ulam sticking out, you have the Beis HaKalifos, the area where they store the Shchita knives. Then the first explanation in Rashi is you have a 5-ana space, rest of that, and then you begin the area of the Toyim and the rest of the Heichal. The second explanation in Rashi is that the Munach is a space between the Toyim, between the side rooms and the main body of the Heichal. So according to that, in other words, you've got a wall of the Heichal, then you've got the space on each side, and then you have the Toyim on each side. So it makes a distinctly different picture, which is why I have these two pictures over here. Worth mentioning also in this connection, by the way, I mean, as far as the Toyim, which we're going to be talking about now, first of all, the Rambam has a different conception of the general shape of the Heichal. Like this, we have the Heichal is shown as like a T shape. You have the center of it, which is 70 amos wide, and then you have the front of it, which has the two wings sticking out to make a total of 100 amos. Later on, and possibly we're going to talk about those various measurements. The Rambam has a conception of it when it comes to the second Beis HaMikdash. He draws it that it's shaped like a trapezoid. It's 100 amos in front and 70 in back. That's clear. It says so in Mishnayos and Midas. But he learns that it's going smoothly from the front to the back so that you have it shaped like a trapezoid rather than like a T. Whether he would say that for the third Beis HaMikdash, I don't know. I don't think it says one way or the other. Also, the Rambam's conception of the Toyim, and this is the Tosfos Yom Tov talks about in his state with Surah Sabayis here on the third and the second and third Beis HaMikdash, the Rambam's conception of the Toyim is that each of them, they're not little rooms one next to the other like Rashi's conception, but rather they're long, skinny rooms that run the full length of the Heichal one next to the other. And they each have different names. So again, would he say that? But the third Beis HaMikdash, again, I don't know.
Anyway, so now Pasuk Vav, that's Slois. So these Slois, these little Toyim, whether we understand them as rooms one next to the other, like the way Rashi does, or whether we understand them as very long, skinny rooms running the full length of the Heichal, like the Rambam does. Anyways, Tzela al Tzela, you have one chamber next to the other, Shtolosh Shloshim Ba'amin, 33 times, because what you have is, on the ground floor, on each side, you have 5 of them. Behind the Kodesh HaKadoshim, you have 1, so that gives you 11 on the ground floor. Then you have a second floor, and then you have a third floor, so it comes out there are 33 of them altogether. Rashi points out in the second Beis HaMikdash, there were 38. The way you had it in the second Beis HaMikdash, you also had 5 on each of the long side, but you had 3 next to one next to the other, or one behind the other, behind the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So instead of having one long, skinny one like you have over here, 20 amos long behind the Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the second Beis HaMikdash, you had 3, according to Rashi, one next to the other, and according to Rambam, one behind the other, and then another 3 on top of those, and then another 2 on top of that. So you have 15 on the first floor, 15 on the second floor, you have on the first floor 13 in the second Beis HaMikdash, another 13 on top of them, and another 12 on top of that. Here in the third Beis HaMikdash, instead you're going to have 11, 11, and 11. Yechezkel continues, Uvois bakira shel abayis latzlois soviv soviv. They come into the wall that of the Beis HaMikdash for the tzlois, for these toyim all around, lius achuzim, so that they'll be held on, v'lo yu achuzim, v'kira boyis, but they should not be held on to the wall of the Beis HaMikdash. Meaning, in other words, like this. And you have a similar kind of thing that was done in the first Beis HaMikdash that's described in the Pesukim in Melachim. In Midas, it also describes it as far as the second Beis HaMikdash. The vote is like this. You have 3 floors of toyim. So that means you have to have beams that form the roof of the ground floor in order to be that, and those will be the floor for the second floor, and similarly from the second to the third floor. Now, the normal way you would do it is you would have holes in the wall and you'd stick those beams into the holes. They didn't want to do that over here, whether because it's not respectful to make holes in the wall of the Heichal, or maybe because eventually over time it might deteriorate.
So instead what they did was, is they made the wall was inset one amma as you go further up. So you have at the bottom level, the wall is six amas thick, as he's going to go on to describe. Then at the you come to a point five amas up, which is the height of the first level of Toyim. Then you have, it gets indented one amma, and now the rest of the wall from there up is only five amas thick. So then on that one amma indent, you can put the ends of the beams that now are going to have. Now you put the ceiling of the first floor on them and the floor of the next floor on top of that. And therefore, the second layer of Toyim is wider, is one amma wider than the layer below them. And the same thing when it comes from the second to the third, you have another inset of one amma. So there, the rest of the wall is four ammas thick. And you have over there on that inset, on that step, is where you put the ends of the beams for the second floor. No, so the wall becomes narrower, therefore the space for the tub becomes wider. Because what you have, in other words, is like this. So yeah. No, right. So here's how it goes then, basically. So the one wall, you've got the outer. Let's go with this understanding of the Toyim verse, let's say. So this wall is the same six abas thick the entire haiga. This wall, which is the wall that the Toyim share with the Kodesh and the Kodesh of Kedushin, the point is like this. So you have, it starts out six amas thick. Then at some point, you have an inset you have over here where the wall now becomes, from here on, it's only five amas thick. And therefore, you have an inset over here of one amma where you can put the ends of the beams on it. Instead of having to pierce holes in the wall, instead you have this inset that you can put on. Therefore, the next top is wider. And the same thing from the second to the third floor. So the first space method should describe the same kind of thing. It brings in the Psukim and Malachim, we have it in Aftarah of Parshas Terumah. Hayetziyah tachtona chomesh ba'amma rochva. It says over there, the bottom yetziyah, the bottom tah is five amas wide. Va'tichlona sheish ba'amma rochva, va'shlish is sheva ba'amma rochva. And it explains the same thing. Kimi grois, nosam abayis, sabib, sabib. The wall is indented more and more as you go further up. So that you don't have to have the beams are put into holes in the wall of the Heichal. So here you have this. So the walls become thinner as you go further up, exactly. By the way, I mean, you have in other places in the Beis Hamikdash, they did that sometimes also. There's Gemara in Yuma that mentions that the walls of the Beis Hamikdash were not perfectly perpendicular. And for that reason, even though in principle from Chatzos and on, the shadows start inclining in a different direction, but in practice, because the walls weren't completely perpendicular, it took a half hour for the shadows to be noticeable on the wall. That is why the earliest they would ever bring the Talmud Shabbat HaBayim is 6.5 hours into the day, and that's why we have Mincha Gdolah 6.5 hours into the day, is because of that. For that matter, if you visit the Kosel nowadays, you see, you look down through the windows that they have in the floor over there, and you can see that the lower levels of it, the wall is much thicker. It becomes gradually thinner as you go up, because that way it's more stable. But here, the idea is not so much for stability as to have room to be able to put the respective floors of the Toyim. And the point is, instead of having to make holes in the wall, this way, as he finishes off, this way they don't have to be held on to the walls of the Beis Hamikdash. Instead, they can be on those insets of one amma at a time. So Rashi finishes off mentioning over here the size of the Toyim. So Rashi says each Ta, assuming that we go again with Rashi's understanding of the Toyim, that they're one room next to another like this, then Rashi says each one would have had to be 12 amas long, totaling 60 amas for five of them. Then you have five amas of wall between one and the next, times five gives you another 25. So there's 85. Then you have the Munach, according to the first understanding that the Munach is between the Toyim and the Beis HaChalifos. And then you have the Beis HaChalifos itself is 10. And there's your 100 length of the Heichal. Now, later on, again, in Pasuk Tes, it actually gives another explanation of the Munach, according to which the Munach is not below the Toyim, but next to it. So according to that, the Toyim would come out longer. Even in the Rashi we have over here, I'm not completely understanding, because it seems there should be six walls. You have one wall above the Toyim, then another one between the first and the second, another one between the second and the third, and so forth, and one at the bottom, unless it actually holds, not exactly like this diagram, that the Ta closest to the west goes all the way to the wall, and there's only a thin wall between them. Maybe he holds at that point, there's not a six amma wall, or five amma wall, or whatever, and therefore he saves five ammas that way. But I don't know. It seems that maybe it's possible also that the Sudashi is actually combining together parts of two different explanations that Rashi is giving, where the copyists maybe combine together two different parts.
All right, Yom Yom Mashiach Gola. What is today? Zayin Tammuz. By the Chanukas Beis HaMikdash HaShlishi, with Mikdash Adonai Koneinu Yadecha, Hashem himself will establish it, then we'll have the Gilui, the point, the B'chol Mokam HaShazgir HaShmi, Obey Alecha Obey Achticha, as it says right after the Aseret HaDibros, where it'll literally be B'chol Mokam and B'chol Olam Kulay, meaning that the perfection of the Beis HaMikdash, where we know in the Beis HaMikdash they're able to say the Shema HaMikdash with the Sias Kapayim, that will exist, that will be revealed and permeate the entire world. By Yomahu Yashem Echad Shema Yachad, like Gemara says, the Kishem Shanich Nichdav Tachani Nikra. So Hashem's name will be able to be pronounced Yud Kei Vav Kei anywhere, because the whole world will be a Dir Lo Yisparach, like the Mishkan and like the Beis HaMikdash. Continuing on halachas of Tefillah Sederech. So you say Tefillah Sederech only once a day. Now the Alter Rebbe says you only say it on the first day. If you stay overnight someplace and then you change your mind and decide to go further, so the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch says you would say it again. The Alter Rebbe apparently would probably say that you say it without Shema Malchus at that point. And if you're going continuously, then the first time, or according to our minhag, if discontinuously you're staying overnight at each place, the first time you say it with Hashem's name, and the rest of the times you say it without Hashem's name, because it's all part of one trip. Our minhag is in particular that even if you're staying overnight or you're staying in the country for a Meshach Zman or whatever, then you say it every day without Shema Malchus. Somebody asked me, Taka, at what point does that change and it would be considered? I thought maybe 30 days, because we often find that once a person has lived in a place for 30 days and it's considered a kliyos, but I don't know. It might also depend. I mean, let's say you're in a bungalow. If you actually own the bungalow, maybe that would be considered, Taka, like a second house of yours. And then at that point, you're not inter vegans anymore, as opposed to, let's say, when you're in a hotel or what have you. So for that, you ask Rabbi Ozwa. I'm not even a cashier. I'm not a cashier.